Thanks, everybody, for coming out tonight for Pumpkin Spice Anonymous. We always have a full room for our November meeting. Thanks, too, for admitting that you're powerless against pumpkin spice. Does anyone want to start us off and talk about using last month?
Pumpkin spice muffins.
Yeah, okay. Thanks, Lorraine. Anybody else?
So I was in a pumpkin stupor and had a pumpkin spice ale just once. Because, you know, they're only out this time of year.
Just once? Just once. Doesn't everything start just once? Okay, come talk to me in July, when there's only three people at the pumpkin spice meeting and you need just one pumpkin spice ale. We have a saying here. If Halloween seems far away, who moved?
What does that mean?
Think about it. Okay, who else?
Pumpkin spice muffins.
Yeah, thanks again, Lorraine. We heard you. Hannah, yes, go ahead.
I ate a box of pumpkin spice Pop-Tarts.
Ooh, that's a lot of pumpkin, yeah.
I know. The kids were really driving me crazy. So I bought some pumpkin spice Pop-Tarts and some Bigelow pumpkin spice autumn tea and some Jell-O pumpkin spice instant pudding. And then I gave the kids whiskey so they would sleep, and I consumed all that stuff.
Hannah, this is just me, but I'm pretty sure that I've heard this story from you before. In fact, I think I hear it every year. And the truth is, you're not really working the program. You're here now because you slipped. Big time. But where were you in August? It's blazing hot. No one's showing up for pumpkin spice meeting. Me and one other person. That's when the real work gets done. Now, who else?
Pumpkin spice muffins.
Lorraine, that's all you ever bring up. You don't belong here. Pumpkin spice muffins are a normal thing to eat. Me, I ate 4 bags of Hershey pumpkin spice kisses. I have a problem. You're wasting our time. You do not belong here.
I like them so much. It helps to talk about it. I didn't expect to be bullied.
She's right, Danny. We told you, no bullying. Lorraine, truthfully, do you have any pumpkin spice muffins in your vehicle right now?
A lot.
All right, just go out there and have a couple. Calm down, and then you can come back in, all right? Anybody else? Daryl, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, I've been having some pumpkin spice lattes.
You're an NFL linebacker.
They just taste good.
You're supposed to be an example for the rest of us. Put on your man panties. What are you, a little pregnant Asian woman who works for a humanities museum? That's who drinks pumpkin spice lattes. Sack up, or I'll come over there and beat some god into you.
Danny, you're an actuary. I could hurt you by accident.
Hey, that's enough. No bullying the NFL guys, Danny. We talked about that, too. I'm going to end our meeting with a prayer, all right? God grant you the serenity to come to this meeting in June when everybody else is having summer cookouts and I'm alone toasting one Kraft Jet Puffed pumpkin spice marshmallow after another. And now he's the guy who bought 6 Venezuelan female mannequins on eBay. Colin McEnroe.
Well, that is true, and we'll explain to you why that is. We have a lot of ground to cover today, and some of it includes Venezuelan female mannequins. But that's to come. That's to come later. Let me, first of all, tell you who's here for The Nose. This is The Nose, our Friday show, our cultural roundtable. Joining us today, Jamel Raglan, making his debut on The Nose. He's a freelance writer, also works for Trinity College. Tracy Wu Fastenberg is, in fact, when you really get down to it, a pregnant Asian woman who works for a humanities museum and does like pumpkin spice things, too. She works for the Mark Twain House, though, and we're very excited to have Tracy Wu Fastenberg here, pumpkin spice and all. Rand Cooper, a writer, his position on pumpkin spice is not known. Writer, food critic, and a whole bunch of other things besides. They're all here. It's time for The Nose. In just a second, in our second segment, we'll talk about a couple things, about the bullying in the NFL, which is far worse than what was going on in that Pumpkin Spice Anonymous meeting. Bullying in the NFL, which we think we can also connect to some of the things going on at UConn right now, which we think we can also connect to the objectification of women, as suggested by an article in the New York Times about the fact that in Venezuela, there's a new demand for mannequins that are bustier, not merely bustier, but wasp-waisted with, according to the New York Times, cantilevered buttocks. I've always wanted cantilevered buttocks. Well, anyway, there's a lot of cultural baggage that goes along with that one. And that's all to come, plus endorsements. Here in the first segment, though, we all saw 12 Years a Slave, this amazing new movie. I guess I just sort of tipped my hand on it, by Steve McQueen. The story of, based on a historical account, first-person account, by a freedman who was kidnapped in Washington and dumped into the slave market, dumped into antebellum Louisiana, has a series of amazing performances. And really kind of, I don't know, I'll let the panel talk a little bit about it. I think it is one of these movies that, first of all, people, Odyssey, it opened kind of narrow, and this weekend, starting today, it's open wider. There are more screens where you can see this movie. I take that as kind of a good sign. But Rand, since you have a vast background in film criticism, including Common Wheel magazine, start us off here. I mean, where do you want to go as we discuss this movie?
Well, I'll just say something about the movie as a movie. There's a whole set of other reactions that have to do with yourself just as a human being and as an American citizen. I'll leave those aside for now. But just to say that I found the film – I think it's a terrific film. I'd seen one of the previous two films by Steve McQueen, and it was called Shame. It came out about 2 or 3 years ago, also with Michael Fassbender. Michael Fassbender has been in all of Steve McQueen's movies. And in that film, which I found very disappointing, although – many critics liked it. Fassbender played a contemporary New Yorker Manhattanite who suffers from a sex addiction. And two conspicuous aspects of the film, which I thought were real weaknesses, recur in this film, and they're turned to great virtues. One, both films are very underwritten. There's not actually a lot of dialogue in Shame, and there isn't that much in 12 Years a Slave either. Two, a problem with Shame was that it seemed reliant on just pictures. It was one set of sort of perfectly posed, placed tableaus after another, but that seemed out of place. There's a conspicuous element of visual beauty in the current film, in 12 Years a Slave, a lot of it having to do with the beauty of nature. And because of the disparity between the serenity and really the aesthetic loveliness of those pictures and the ugliness of the human cruelty that's foregrounded in the relationships, that creates a constant, really harrowing contrast between those two levels of the film. Similarly, there are excruciating scenes where nothing is being said, and certainly the most, one of two most excruciating scenes in the film come when the main character, played by the terrific British Nigerian actor Chiwetel Ejiofor, is almost lynched. He's left to hang, dangling on, just standing on his tiptoes in a sort of ever diminishing or ever deepening little pit of mud. And he's left there for hours. There's no dialogue during that time, and we see everyone else's life just going on in the background. So silence and the lack of dialogue are used just really to extraordinary effect in this film. And I was fascinated to see a filmmaker I thought, you know, was promising but really hadn't done it, turn all of his flaws into virtues.
By the way, if you want to join this conversation with us, 860-275-7266. I'll say it a little bit slower now, 860-275-7266. You may tweet us. Tweetmaster Greg Hill is in the house. You may tweet at us at WNPR Colin and be tweeted to by following WNPR Colin. Jamel Raglan, you know we've seen movies about slavery before. We're about, I think, 36 years away, so that's more than your lifetime, from Roots. I don't know. Are we seeing slavery in a different way, a way that it hasn't been presented to us before?
Actually, LeVar Burton, since you mentioned Roots, LeVar Burton gave an interview, I believe, last week where they brought that up, that coming up on the 36th anniversary of Roots, and now this movie, 12 Years a Slave, has been released. And what Mr. Burton said was that he felt that Roots might have been that breakthrough for slave narratives, that there might have been an increase in the acknowledgement of slave narratives in American popular culture, American film, and American television, and things of that nature, but that didn't actually happen. And so the question was, did he believe that it was going to happen this time? And he said that he hoped so, that this would be the point where this would start to happen. And there's another film, the name escapes me right now, that was a trailer was shown for the film during, prior to 12 Years a Slave, about not a slave, but a mulatto woman who has these various family issues of acceptance for being a black woman in a white high-class society. And so you see that these films are moving forward, that we see now this film, we see 12 Years a Slave, and they asked Mr. Burton directly about Django, if he felt that Django Unchained is what got this going. And I think that it's unfortunate that it had to be Django Unchained that seemed to remind people that slavery did happen and that slavery is a part of the American experience, that the slave experience had to be commodified as some sort of revenge narrative by Quentin Tarantino before others start to see, well, there's profitability in slave narratives. And the way that that profitability was presented was by basically absolving America of its guilt through slavery through this film. Basically, yes, we have some of the brutality of slavery is present in Django Unchained, but the slave gets his revenge. The evil slave master gets his comeuppance and everything is kind of happily ever after in the end. Of course, that's not what happened ever, but that had to be presented first for this kind of like cathartic feel-good film to happen first before we can get into the 12 Years a Slave, before we can get into some of the other films that may or may not come. Whether or not this represents a moment when we are going to start moving forward on these issues, I'm doubtful about that. I think that this is just kind of the follow the leader thing that happens in Hollywood from time to time, and I'd like to be wrong, but I'd like to revisit this question in 5 years, and we'll see where we are then.
Yeah, I think I read the same LeVar Burton interview that you did, and that's what he was kind of saying too. It's kind of like, is that what's going to happen? Is every 35 years we're going to have another film like this to remind everybody what they forgot, rather than there being some kind of continuity of memory? Tracy Wu Fastenberg, you're pregnant right now. That means you're emotionally labile. You told me right away after you saw the movie.
I cried like a baby through the last 20 minutes of it, and I went by myself in the afternoon with a very interesting crowd of retirees. So, you know, a lot of the comments were very audible throughout the whole thing, if you've ever been to an afternoon matinee on a weekday. And so I was by myself. I let go because there was so much horrific imagery throughout the thing that in some movies you become numb to it. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the really delicately balanced thing that happened here was that it built upon on itself until you got to a point where you couldn't handle it emotionally anymore. Because every single time something horrible happened to one of the characters, and it was usually one of the slave characters, it was always one of the slave characters, you know, it just wrenched your heart out even more and even more. And even at the very end, when you have this sort of happy ending, but it's not because it was reality, it was what really happened, your heart just breaks when he walks in and sees, I'm sorry for the spoiler, but he sees his family and he apologizes. Mm-hmm. He apologizes for the way he looks. He apologizes for what he's put them through. And you can kind of see how during those 12 years, he's sort of been broken.
And we should say there's almost no way to spoil this movie. If you know anything about the history of it, there's no way to spoil it, because even the title of it basically tells you something, and it's hard to do a plot spoiler. I wouldn't worry too much if we're talking about things and you haven't seen the movie.
Still, go see it.
Yeah, go see it. Absolutely.
Chiwetel Ejiofor is an actor of extraordinary range. I interviewed him a number of years ago because I was doing a profile on the director Stephen Frears, and Stephen Frears directed a film called Dirty Pretty Things, where Chiwetel Ejiofor plays a cab driver, a Nigerian cab driver in London, who gets involved in black market organ transplant sales. So it's a very, very dark film. But he also was playing in a Noel Coward play, and I forget which it was, in which he had a lead role in London at that time, and I went and saw that. This is an actor who can do almost anything. His face, his remarkably interesting face, seems to bear a sort of default cast of sorrow and grief. That's true not just in this movie. It's part of the interesting look of his face. It's hard to imagine an actor who would have been better for this role, particularly given that he wasn't allowed to say much. As we know, one of the reasons he's not allowed to say much is that he could not betray the fact, in his circumstances after having been sold into slavery, that he's a highly educated and literate person. So there's a sort of additional layer of irony that goes into sort of the underwrittenness of this.
Speaking of the writtenness of this, maybe it was just me. I thought there was almost a Shakespearean cadence.
Yes.
when people did speak.
I actually wrote that down in my notes, that it was
right.
Beautiful dialogue.
And that's the attempt, always interesting, to try to find, to reconstruct what might have been a historically accurate version of, and presumably that's based in part on the text that he left behind. But one critic commented that this is the best film ever made about slavery, and this goes back to Jamel's comment. You know, there haven't been that many. Mm-hmm. And if you think about other film treatments of the great national scars on our national soul, Vietnam, I mean, so many films like that, that there have only been a handful of films about slavery, and that almost none of them have done what this film does, and that is give it from the point of view exclusively, you know, of the slaves. It's very interesting. And I think, you know, one thing that this film does is it is told wholly through the perspectives and the visions of the victim. They own the narrative, and the white people are depicted. There's a range from sort of relatively kind-hearted but deeply hypocritical and finally unable to stand up for anything to the psychotically sadistic, and you know, who do things that are really very, very hard to watch. And the only last thing I'd say about it is there's a moral quandary watching this film. I find it. It's so – you see the things that are done to people, the cruelty that's done in the name of a system that people openly espouse, and you sit on the other side of a pretty big historical and moral gulf and from the slave-owning people. And you know, to try to – it's I don't even know what I'm saying. It's very confounding to try to imagine being them.
Well, I think I know what you're saying. And Jamel, you know, one of the things that I was sort of thinking, similar to what Rand's saying at the end of this movie, is, wow, I feel, you know, to whatever extent, I didn't watch Django Unchained. I refused to watch it. I see most movies that come out, most major movies. I just was not willing to subject myself to this or to put my sensibilities about such an incredibly complicated topic in the hands of Quentin Tarantino, who I don't trust for squat anyway. But, you know, to whatever extent I might have been sort of inoculated against my guilt by that movie if I'd seen it, I certainly would have been reinfected with my guilt seeing 12 Years a Slave. But at the end of it, I was sort of wondering, well, what do I do with all these feelings that I have right now? What ought I to do with all the feelings that I have now? In some ways, and the writer Alex Beam was communicating with me today and saying that he felt at minimum it certainly took things that had became abstract in your mind. A word like abolition, you know, doesn't really – it means something historical and abstract to you most of the time. Now, you know, here it is. Here's what it's about. Even as Alex said, somebody like John Brown, who might have seen like, you know, an unbalanced fanatic, you know, and sort of a loose cannon, and quite literally. You look at all this and you think, oh, maybe if I knew about that, maybe I'd be with John Brown at Harper's Ferry. But I don't know. It's sort of you walk out of the movie theater and you think, well, I feel a little bit different about stuff, but what do I do with those feelings?
To go to Rand's point about the historical and moral divide, the gulf that we find ourselves from the film's material and our current day lives, I would argue that we're not quite as far away from that as we think we are. And that what I thought about during the film and about slavery in general is how do you implicitly acknowledge the humanity of slaves by the fact that you speak to them, by the fact that you have sex with them, by the fact that you acknowledge that these are tasks that a human must complete. So on one hand, you must implicitly acknowledge their humanity while simultaneously denying it by treating them as property, by referring to them by the N-word, by law referring to them as property. And the only conclusion I could come to was that you can only make that sort of juxtaposition work in the confines of a system, and that slavery was not simply a bunch of individuals who enslaved a bunch of other individuals. It was an entire system of laws, of customs, of traditions, of behaviors and expectations, behaviors from slaves to masters, also of masters to slaves, and there were expectations on both sides. And when we think about it in those terms, I think that this is kind of the way in which we connect these things to the NFL bullying, to the Venezuela, models, to those things, is through the way that we inhabit these systems, that it's very easy for us to make these judgments about slavery now and that they're horrible. But if we were back then and we lived in this completely pervasive system, how would we actually respond to it? How would I, as a black man and most likely a slave in that era, have responded to it? How would anyone else have responded to it? And I like to think, how are people going to think about us 150 years later from now? And the absolutely abhorrent systems that we participate in on a daily basis, systems like privatized prisons, systems like sweatshop labor, systems like for-profit healthcare, these types of things that I think people in 150 years will say, what were they thinking? But we wake up in the morning, this is the life that we know, this is the life that we live, and we go to sleep at night, and we do it for the majority of our lives. And you hope that when people look back on us, that they'll understand that this is just what they knew. This might be evil and it might be wrong from how we think about it now, but this is what they knew. And it's not in any way to excuse slavery as anything less than absolutely horrible, but this is what these people knew. When you watch a film like this and you say, well, why didn't he just run away? Where could he have run to? Mm-hmm. Where could he have, what was the actual expectation for this man in a land that he's unfamiliar with people that are openly hostile to him, to actually have run to? For the character that Benedict Cumberbatch played, what is the actual expectation for him, for a white man in the South, to actually stand up for this slave?
His way to stand up for him was to pass him off to somebody else.
But within the confines of the system.
Right, within the system.
Yeah. You know, and his character, who, by the way, for those who haven't seen the film, he represents the most kind of tolerant and liberal of the slave owners. And I found, I mean, his character, you could clearly understand the rationalization he's making himself. He considers himself enlightened because he's putting himself in a situation where there are these openly sadistic slave owners. Ultimately, it doesn't matter. He's not enlightened at all. And when push comes to shove, he does what everyone else does, and he sells his property, and he insists on the contractual realities of humans as property and sells them down the river. And gets mad at the victims for forcing this contradiction to the surface.
Right. Even the character of Brad Pitt, who is the most enlightened Caucasian that we see down south, you know, he comes from Canada. He's got these ideas. He's very vocal about them. When Northrop asks him, you know, will you help me? He has those moments of fear and hesitation. He says, I'm afraid to do it. You know, he's got these really deeply ingrained, passionate beliefs about how slavery is wrong and how it shouldn't exist and that it goes against human nature. But even he has his moments of hesitation. Thank God at the end, he does the right thing. But because he's been enmeshed in the system as well, he isn't sure if he can do the right thing.
We're going to switch gears here pretty soon. So if you want to call in and talk about this, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. Just a couple of quick reactions to what you guys are saying. First of all, actually, I thought Brad Pitt was sort of the only inferior acting job in the movie. I didn't really sort of get very much interior qualities to anything he was doing. But, you know, this is a movie where I feel like there are scenes, individual scenes, that we could talk about for an hour. And I do think the scene that Rand alluded to, where the protagonist is hanging, just his feet just touching the ground and constantly making these, as Rand said, ever-growing, more alarming indentations in the mud below him. And he's on Benedict Cumberbatch's plantation, the most enlightened of the slaveholders. But one of the things you see there, as this thing goes on for what seems like hours and hours and hours that this is happening, and daily life begins to take place around it, is that Benedict Cumberbatch is also the only they have to go find him, right? That's the only way that this can stop, is that because there's no moral law or anything like this. There's nothing that anybody is susceptible, and so whatever Benedict Cumberbatch has decided the right thing is to do, that's the only out, really. Everybody has to wait for this guy to show up and cut down a man who's.
And what is so brilliant and terrifying about that scene is, as we said, life is going on in the background. Other slaves are doing their chores. No one's really paying attention. No one's even watching. They're afraid to. And the sun sets, and his hanging there near death almost becomes one of these natural processes that we see, like the wind blowing in the trees, the sun going up and down, and it's this powerful statement that in this corrupt and perverted world, this is a natural thing that's happening here, and it's a horrifying moment.
I also thought that I agree with you about his use of beautiful nature photography, and usually when that happens, particularly in Steven Spielberg movies, I feel like there's something kind of treacly going on. This time I really thought the beauty was set against this incredibly jarring, horrible reality in a really interesting way that occasioned dozens of different thoughts for me. But also there is that sense of the wilderness that you feel like he can't run away. You're wondering if you're wondering for 2 seconds, why doesn't he run away? He doesn't run away because where would he go? You know, I mean, you really feel like this very inhospitable world is out there. And that one time where he does take a little side trip and runs into, we won't spoil this for you, another horrifying scene, you realize, oh, there is nowhere to go. We're running out of time here, and I noticed some people who are calling in. I'd love to get at least one call on the air because a bunch of people are starting to call here. Let me just quickly tell you what's going on. We're talking about 12 Years a Slave. We're talking about 12 Years a Slave with our guests, Rand Cooper, Jamel Raglan, Tracy Wu Fastenberg. And if I don't get one of these calls up on the board here, I think we're going to – yeah, we should – oh, well, here's one. Let's go to Errol in New Britain. We do have other things to go on to. And I think our next topic, we can draw a pretty bright line from where we are now to where we'll be next. But here's Errol in New Britain. Hi.
Hello. How are you?
What's on your mind?
Well, I was very interested in what you talked about. I want to see this movie. I was thinking about George Washington. I was studying a biography on him, and he seems to have a very unique position. After the founding of the country, he thought the very first thing that had to be done was the dissolving of slavery. And in fact, what isn't taught a lot in schools, which I found surprising finding on my own, doing my own historical, you know, amateur history studying, is that he said back then, at the time, you know, like right now, it was an old system that was under monarchy and needed to change under this new invented system that has never existed before, and that slaves not only should be integrated in the military, and this was in the 1780s he was saying this, but also they needed to be educated, and as he put it, to useful purpose, or else the country cannot perpetuate. And in
but
fact,
but he did own slaves, however. I mean, that's the other problem with this. He owned slaves. I mean, he may have said all those things, but he owned slaves.
I know he owned slaves, and he was one of those people that I feel, and you could correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like he was someone who was enlightened throughout life, not at the onset of life.
That could
so
be.
He owned slaves, and he wanted them to be, as a matter of fact, in his will, he decreed that they were taught to read. And released and freed.
Yeah, he treated his he did treat his slaves better in his will than Jefferson did, actually. We're going to have to take a quick break here. We're just running out of time. We've got so much that we need to try to cover here. One thing that would help in future episodes, I always say this, but call in sooner so we can work into the discussion before we run out of time. We've got to take a break. We've got to move on. We're back. This is The Nose. With us are Jamel Raglan, Tracy Wu Fastenberg, Rand Cooper. We were talking about 12 Years a Slave. I'm sorry if you called in kind of late, and we have to move on. We have other topics we want to hit. This one, I think we all thought maybe there were bright lines you could draw from one to the other. As many of you know, the NFL has been convulsed with the latest in a long series of NFL controversies. This is a time when the cracks in the egg of the NFL are really visible suddenly, mostly in the form of concussions. But this week, kind of a startling thing happened. A lineman for the Miami Dolphins quit the team, quit the NFL, quit pro football, as far as anyone can tell, because he was being harassed, because he was being bullied. Perhaps significantly, the person bullying him was a fellow lineman who was white. Some of the bullying did include the same. One of the thoughts that I had sort of had was that it seemed as though Richie Incognito, the lineman who was bullying Jonathan Martin, spoke many lines that could have come out of the mouth of Epps, the horrible slaveholder played by Michael Fassbender, and vice versa. They kind of spoke each other's lines, but there was certainly a lot of use of the N-word, threatening to defecate in Martin's mouth and do other horrible things to him. He was coerced into paying $15,000 for a trip to Vegas that Richie Incognito didn't even take. And some of this was also this kind of sense, as it unfolded, as it was commented on by other athletes, that, yes, this was like a line was crossed, but on the other hand, it wasn't all that much out of the ordinary, too. This is sort of how things are, and you have to go to war with these people, and you have to get them ready to go to war. I don't know, Rand, I'm going to make you start again, just because I think you were the one who sort of set us hounds on this trail.
Well, there's so much to me that's interesting in this, and I also have an ancient background of having played football when I was a young person, having loved football, and I still watch football. But there was an article that used the phrase "taming the NFL" to describe a whole set of policy changes, and starting with the ones on the field that are trying to make the sport less dangerous. Now, Looming over this is the specter of the devastation of an older generation of NFL players who are who have chronic brain encephalopathy, who have rampant depression, very high suicide rates, and we know that a many hundred million dollar lawsuit was just reached with the league to compensate these players. So there is the sense that the level of violence is now paying off an unrecognized, previously heretofore unrecognized level of violence. It's basically taken out a generation of players. That's dictating changes on the field down, today. And we know that special rules have been created in the past 3 or 4 years to protect quarterbacks, to protect receivers, to outlaw certain kinds of collisions, which previously were not only allowed, but were selling points for the sport, the kind of thing that you would see over and over again. So one way to understand what's going on with the bullying issue this week is that it's sort of the other side, the emotional, psychological, and workplace counterpart to the attempt to make the sport less violent. Now, there's a whole set of ritual hazings that were often explicitly misogynistic and filthy and raucous that have been designed to build a certain sort of warrior camaraderie. So the question is, what does it mean to tame a sport that in many fundamental ways is based on violence, marketed through violence, and based on a sort of image of the warrior and code of the warrior? And that's what makes this so interesting. There's a collision of two cultures going on here.
I think there's a collision of a lot of cultures. And Jamel, I mean, I don't know whether I'm drawing too many lines. In some ways, I really did see these two things as very similar. Jonathan Martin being very much like the protagonist of 12 Years a Slave, in that he comes from a different background. He's not only educated at Stanford. Both of his parents are Harvard graduates. He's really not used to any kind of culture in which he is completely marginalized and treated like crap, which is basically the way that he's supposed to accept there. And to me, the NFL is, even though I'm also a football fan too, but at times watching them talk about the combine, which is the part of the season every year where players are evaluated out of college and they're described in these very raw physical terms, not at all unlike what Paul Giamatti as the slave trader in 12 Years a Slave is, you know, look at this, look at his chest size, look at his wingspan, look at his this, look how high his knees go when he jumps. To me, this is like a place where men are commodified. I mean, they get compensated a lot more than slaves, but they're made into commodities in ways that seem kind of familiar to me.
Oh, I agree. And I think that brings you right to a great point I want to make about what Rand was saying about the taming of the NFL, that I don't think the taming of the NFL has much to do at all with making it less violent, but the NFL was pretty openly pursuing expanding the league expanding the season to 18 games a couple of years ago. And a lot of these initial rule changes were rule changes made in that direction to make sure that the players pretty much literally physically lasted 18 games to get some more dollars out of the season. They wanted to add an overseas game for every team. That would have been one of the games that they added. And they wanted to take the two preseason games and make the last two preseason games and make those into regular season games. And so these rule changes were initially started to move the NFL in that direction, and then the health issue really came forward and the NFL backed off of moving into the 18-game schedule. But these health issues and the violence of the sport, you can't really decouple the two, and you can't really decouple how the NFL is marketed from the violence. And when you look at the commodification of these players, the way in which African-American men primarily are commodified in this way, are described in these same ways that in a lot of ways do resemble a slave market, that the historical parallels are undeniable. And you've heard the term thrown around sometimes, you may or may not have heard it, that these are basically million-dollar slaves, that when they're sold, when their utility is up, they're traded to other people. They're passed around through the league like property in a way. You have a contract that, you know, you can break, but you're liable for. Just ask Ricky Williams. And you don't really have – you can get out of that contract, but you got to pay your way out of it. And
well, you'll even hear terms – like one of the terms that's used a lot, thrown a lot in descriptions among fans, among sports writers, is stud. He's a stud. This player is a stud. I mean, it couldn't be more raw. But Tracy Wu-Fastenberg, I want to make sure that we're really talking about this bullying case too, because obviously it's easy for the bullying case to spread out into a completely legitimate moral indictment of the NFL. But for you, I'm guessing you probably follow the NFL a little less closely than the rest of us. And how did the bullying case, the case of this one young man who couldn't put up with the way that he was being treated and spoken to, look to you?
I didn't look at it the way that a lot of the sportscasters and a lot of the commentators and a lot of his own teammates are looking at it. Because I am a self-proclaimed football hater. I'm sorry, guys. I'm really sorry. I know I'm surrounded by football fans
here.
Glad
to have you here.
My husband loves football.
Move out of the way of the TV, but we're glad to have you.
My husband loves football, and that's pretty much the source of all my football knowledge. But being somebody who doesn't follow it at all, of course the bullying story came across, you know, my computer screen. And I was struck first by Richie Incognito's name, which I was floored to find out is his real name. Actually, John Stewart said something funny yesterday that it's probably the least apropos name for a gentleman that size. But I actually, my heart went out to Martin because, you know, you think of this young man who is an intellectual, who has had a very different life than one might expect from a lot of football players. You know, you think a lot of the football players that go through the college system are maybe not the most academic. Some of them certainly are, but when you're thinking about the stereotype, it isn't usually that case, and this young man was. And he was on a team full of guys who were probably supposed to be his teammates, his comrades, his brothers. And I know there's some, you know, stuff that goes on in families, but that's not what you do to a family member or a team member. And, you know, having grown up with sports in school where it's supposed to be about teamwork and being part of a team, you don't say those things to another human being, let alone a teammate. And then to hear him called weak, or he needed to be toughened up, or maybe the management sort of encouraged that sort of behavior, it's just heartbreaking. And it doesn't exactly make me want to go watch a football.
Well, speaking of family, Tony Siragusa, former lineman for two NFL teams, now a sideline commentator on TV, said, they talk about teams being a family. When you're in the locker room, that's like your home. Things are handled in there and said in there that shouldn't be brought out to the media. And plainly, because the media and really the real world can't handle a lot of those things and things that happen in that locker room, I think Martin should have confronted Incognito. I think he should have went up to him and said, what's your problem? Richie Incognito is 100% wrong. If a guy goes and says that to you, do you go and run? Just be a man. I'm tired of people going and running from their problems. I mean, some version of that was said over and over again this week, Jamel, that among NFL players, that Martin should have handled it himself somehow, or that he should have confronted Incognito, that he shouldn't have stepped out of this picture. Although, I don't think we would say that in any other place of employment. But what was your reaction to that?
My reaction to that was that everyone's entitled to their opinion, as wrong as it may be. And I think that Tony Siragusa was wrong in this case. I do think that he has a point in terms of stepping out to the media, only because the media becomes this gigantic echo chamber where you turn on ESPN and all you hear is about Richie Incognito in this case. And it kind of creates this thing where you talk about the issue without really talking about the issue. You talk about NFL bullying, but you don't actually talk about masculinity and the way that masculinity is constructed. And so it becomes this really thing. It becomes this kind of warped issue. It warps the issue away from what it actually is about, the way in which you just define masculinity and manhood, that masculinity means never showing emotion. Masculinity means never showing fear. Masculinity means never letting anyone see you cry. And there are lots and lots of men who have to live with that, you know, and we all have to live with that. And I've lived with that, and it's been a big problem in some of my personal relationships. It's been a big problem in a lot of men's relationship where they feel like they don't have the opportunity to actually be whole human beings, that being a man does not, a man means not being affected by hazing and bullying, which is absurd because the explicit point of bullying someone is to elicit an emotional response. And then when someone has an emotional response, we call them weak for having it, even though that's what we're trying to get out of them. And so when it steps out into the media as it's currently constructed, it becomes this thing where people like Tony Siragusa get a soapbox to spew their nonsense again, where, you know, ESPN becomes this kind of thing where it's like, should he have done this or should he have not have? Whereas instead of being a constructive conversation about, well, okay, bullying is bad, but there's lots of forms of bullying. How do we look at this from a broader perspective and how masculinity destroys men, how masculinity destroys women, as we're going to talk about when we get to the Venezuelan, I don't know why this word keeps escaping me.
Mannequins.
Yeah. Thank you.
Actually, if we're going to get there, we're going to have to wrap this up pretty quickly. We're fighting the clock right now. But, Rand, I guess one of the things that I notice, I see it in the Siragusa stuff and a lot of the responses, and we see it all over the place, too. If you question this culture, you know, in any way. If you question it, I mean, somebody in the media who covers it, I've experienced this. Jeff Jacobs experienced it. If you question sports culture and say that it may have a toxic effect on human relations in any way, whether you're Jonathan Martin, a sports writer, or anybody else, you will get slapped down by it. I mean, you will be bullied in a different way.
What's interesting to me is that while there has been some predictable pushback from a number of players who have defended Incognito, a lot of sports writers and commentators are going the other way with this. And I thought the most cogent thing that I heard was a comment by Kevin Blackstone, who's an ESPN commentator. I wasn't familiar with him before. He said, the NFL needs to embrace Jonathan Martin. And he said, here's why. Jonathan Martin is a new age kind of football player who can compartmentalize his violence on the field and not take it with him off the field. Richie Incognito is the exact opposite. And that's the kind of player, as we know, the dirty player, the violent player, the aggressive player, that's the kind of player who has consistently given the NFL a bad name. I think this is going to dovetail with the policies that are, being taken to make the game safer, and it's a very interesting moment. I think it really is a tipping moment in the way, and it's all the things that Jamel was talking about with masculinity and the rigid codes of masculinity. I mean, maybe there's a chance that this thing is actually going
to
change.
I'd love to see Jonathan Martin in green and gold next year as a Packers fan. But we've got to quickly, so we got about just a few seconds here to talk about another article. I think Rand directed us at this one, too, that in Venezuela, this was on page one of the New York Times, they are actually changing mannequins because the mannequins were a little bit more sort of normally formed. And because of sort of trends in what's accepted as physical beauty, this particular Venezuelan mannequin maker had made his mannequins more busty, more wasp waist, and with more cantilevered buttocks. And as a result, they were selling a lot better. His mannequins are everywhere. They're at the front of the store. You walk in the store, and that's what you see. So you don't like football, but you are a woman. You get to start this conversation off.
This article broke my heart. I was just sitting there going, I can't believe this is happening. Whether it's in the United States or Venezuela or anywhere, you know, if you think about a lot of Western cultures, there's been so much work done in past decades to sort of break this, you know, this is what a woman should look like. This is what a woman should be. And as I told you guys, as a short, stumpy, flat-chested, flat-butted female, you know, I don't fulfill any of those stereotypes of what's supposed to be beautiful. And it took me a while, you know, well into high school to realize that I can still, you know, be beautiful in a different way. There's many other things besides physicality that plays into who you are. And I think that a lot of females of all ages work towards that. And then now to have this sort of other side coming out where I think it was Miss Venezuela that said that, you know, inner beauty is something that ugly people made up to make themselves
feel better.
Actually,
it was the director of the pageant. I say that inner beauty doesn't exist. That's something that unpretty women invented to justify themselves. That was his quote.
And I think that's a lot of BS because that can apply to unpretty males, unpretty females, whatever. You know, and if all you're reduced to is either being a stud for the NFL because of your physicality or a hot model with voluptuous curves, then what does that say about our society?
Nice linkage. All right. You're each going to get about 60 seconds, unfortunately, just for us to but Jamel, give us your take.
I think that when you look at all these things, going back to what I said earlier, it's just a matter of systems. Systems of racism, systems of misogyny, systems of capitalism, of making people feel a certain way about themselves so that they buy things, so that they go out and get this plastic surgery, buy this product, get this to feel better about themselves. That all of these things are the predictable outcome of systems and people who are invested in those systems because it makes them money, and that this is the thing that all of these things have in common. These new mannequins sell better. The NFL owners make money. During slavery, it was about money. All these things have to do with ensuring that these systems perpetuate to make someone else rich, and we always have to ask that question. Who is getting rich off of these things?
You got 60 seconds.
What's interesting to me in this is that the existence of these new mannequins reflects a kind of insidious dynamic between the aesthetics of the mannequin and the prevalent practice of various surgical plastic surgery procedures in Venezuela. So the mannequins are actually in some ways a response to the fact that so many women have had themselves altered, but they also spur further alterations. To me, there was an ominous point 20 years ago, whenever, in American plastic surgical procedures, when people who had them done stopped hiding it and actually began to boast about the procedures that they had. And Venezuela represents that to the extreme. To me, any culture that not only loses sight of but willingly throws, jettisons the concept of inner beauty is in serious trouble.
All right. Great place to stop. Depressing place to stop. Great place to stop. We'll come back with plugs, endorsements, things like that after this.
I'm a girl and by me that's only great. I am proud that my silhouette is curvy. That I walk with a sweet and girlish gait. With my hips kind of swivelly and swervy, I adore being dressed in something frilly.
Damn it. Hey, intern, you were supposed to get me the pumpkin spice frappuccino, not the pumpkin spice mocha latte. Get it right, rookie, or I'll come down there and fuck your shit up. I'm sorry, what's that? Is this extension 8504?
No, this is Mr. Franklin.
Oh, sorry, Mr. Franklin. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, with help from our interns, Corey Breen and Greg Dyson. Thanks to the mighty Dankosky Art Players for voiceover work on the intro. They're Greg Hill, Patrick Scahill, Heather Brandon, and Betsy Kaplan. The part of Bill Curry was played by Ricky Williams. We'll be back on Tuesday with one of our surprise news magazine shows. And now, back to Colin.
All right, it's time for plugs and endorsements. The plugs are just sort of things that are coming up. And yes, Rand and I will both be at Real Art Ways on November 13th, which I think is next Wednesday. Real Art Ways for Flash Fiction Funny. It's a new collection of very short humor pieces. A new book of these pieces. Rand and I will each be reading our selections and at least one other selection by somebody else. So for a night of reading and humor, and there'll be lots of other writers, not just the two of us. But anyway, then I also have to plug something of my own, which I try not to do too much. But November 17th, which is a week from this Sunday, I will be narrating Peter and the Wolf out at UConn with the amazing puppet troupe that they have out there. Peter and the Wolf will be at the Jorgensen Center for the Performing Arts in stores on Sunday, November 2nd at 2 p.m. I have done this with these puppets before, and they are amazing. It's really fun. The orchestra is great, too. We're going to have a great time. So if you like Peter and the Wolf, do that. All right. So endorsements. Where should we go first? Tracy Wu Fastenberg, what have you got?
First, I have to endorse these pumpkin spice caramels that you brought in because those are freaking amazing.
They were purchased at Desain just for you since you're eating for two.
Delicious. But I need to endorse, since we are running up against the holiday season and people are starting to do their holiday shopping, don't get just stuff for people. I really want to encourage people to maybe think about making a donation to charity in somebody's name or giving them an experience or something that isn't just going to clutter their homes and their closets with stuff that they're probably not going to use. If you have to buy an ugly tie, there's plenty of great charities that might be selling a tie that ties into something that person loves, or making a donation so they don't even have to have that thing. So get a little creative with your Christmas shopping.
Or a membership at one of the many arts and cultural institutions.
Exactly.
It would be a good thing to give. It's a great endorsement. It's a great idea. What have you got, Rand?
Please do go on to the Real Artways website and come to the event next Wednesday. None of these stories we're reading is longer than 750 words, so it's a great event for the ADHD crowd. But before that, you might want to go out to dinner at a new restaurant just opened this week in West Hartford Center. If you like Treva, the Italian restaurant in the center of West Hartford, which is terrific. Dorian Pucco, who's the owner, has just opened around the corner on La Salle a bistro called A Vert, as in French, meaning to green. It emphasizes the local fresh quality of a lot of the food. It is also a bit of a risk to name your restaurant a name that will be called Avert by most people, but it's A Vert, and it's also very wittily Treva spelled backwards. It's a great restaurant. It's cool inside, French bistro food, not expensive. You'll love it.
I love Treva. All right, Jamel, what have you got?
For my endorsement, I would say it was around restaurants. That was a great idea. And my personal favorite bar and restaurant in downtown Hartford, Vaughn's on Pratt Street. It's a place I really love. It's quiet. It's got a good crowd, a good ambiance, a good vibe. And I find myself there maybe once every week or once every couple of weeks. It's a really great place to go visit. And if you're looking for something to do during the day before you head there, this weekend, taking place in Hartford at various locations is the One Nation Divisible Conference, where integration meets innovation. It's an education conference that's going to be happening at various locations around Hartford. There will be some panel discussions tomorrow, I know, at the Learning Corridor near New Britain Avenue.
Okay, we'll send people to a website. Say what it's called again so they can Google it. What's the name of the...
Where Integration Meets Innovation.
Where Integration Meets Innovation in Hartford. Thanks so much for that. Very quickly, endorse two other movies featuring Chiwetel Ejiofor, the star of 12 Years a Slave, Children of Men, and Serenity. Try to watch all of the Firefly box set before you watch Serenity. He's kind of a bad guy in Serenity. Also, read Frank Rich's essay on 12 Years a Slave in New York Magazine. Thanks to everybody. Thanks to our staff. We'll be back on Tuesday.
Avon, Farmington, yeah. She on the radio. She on the radio.
On the radio, baby.
You and me talking, laughing down on
college back and
roll. And then I gave the kids whiskey so they would sleep.
Wait. Don't tell me it was pumpkin whiskey.
I know.
Ugh, giving kids whiskey is one thing, but pumpkin whiskey? I thought I knew you.